Thanks everyone for coming. If you have heard about this talk, I'm sorry for that, because like this talk has been given in the 8 from Qubit meeting, but from another more high energy perspective. I will give the talk from the more condensed matter perspective, but the content is almost like the same. So the title is like page map recovery in quantum many body systems. Like page map, something that you might not know, so I will explain it. What does it mean and why we would like to start it. Okay, let's start with some basic stuff. So the outline theme is that, you know, like this quantum phase of matter, there are many phases of matter, but their characterizations are in terms of long-range entanglement. When you talk about entanglement, then perhaps the first thing that you think about is the entanglement entropy. And the entanglement entropy is called a bipartite entanglement measure, meaning that you are dividing your system into A and B. The whole system is in a pure state. You just consider one part entangled with another. And this is and the entanglement entropy is given by the Smith decomposition, which is this, and then you just compute the entropy as the Shannon entropy. So it's known that like this quantity is very useful. For example, in the ground state of CFT, you have this logarithmic scaling with the central charge, and for the topological order, if you compute the entropy, there is some topological entropy. And these are the examples where disentanglement quantities give you universal information about the phase of matter. And the question we ask from a more information theoretic perspective is, what does it mean to actually to compute this entanglement entropy, right? Like, you can write down the abstract expression like this, but why? Why this quantity is important? From the information perspective, actually, we know that entanglement entropy quantifies how much Bell pair can be extracted from the state under local operations and the classical communications, which is also known as LOCC. Like in quantum information theory, like people say that local operations and the classical communications, they are kind of free, but the Bell pair is kind of some kind of resource. Bipartite entanglement, in the sense of this resource, is like can produce the Bell pair entanglement. And also the Bell pair entanglement also as a resource you can prepare by LOCC any bipartite entangled state. And the question is how much Bell pair you can extract from this entangled state, or how much Bell pair you need to prepare this entangled state. And it turns out that the entanglement entropy is exactly what characterizes this. So if you give me like many copies of this pure state, then you and you allow me to do LOCC, then the best I can give you is n copies of the Bell pair, where n equals to the number n equal to the entanglement entropy. So that's the question.
Hi. So is this a property of the mixed state of A?
No, it's the property of the entanglement between A and B. It's not just like if you just give me A, then I cannot do the job, right? Because A is just a mixed state. I need both system A and B to prepare all the entanglement pair.
Now suppose I have the combined system of A and B.
Yeah.
Depending on where I put the entanglement card, entanglement entropy will be different.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Then what is that N?
By local operations, I mean local in A and local in B. You can do whatever thing in A, like whatever like non-local thing in A, but that's also count as local in this sense.
Ah, I see. So N is determined by what I mean by locality.
Yeah, right. Yeah, like in this setting, like A and B, we think of Alice and Bob living in two separate experiments, right? So A is local within itself, B is local within itself.
So also just to clarify, if I use the geometry in the picture above, then SA, if it's 1 plus 1 DCFT, then the coefficient is C over 6, not C over 3.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So So this entanglement, this is quite clear, like this bipartite entanglement case. And but then if we want more information, like we may want to consider multipartite entanglement, where for example you have a pure state in ABC and you divided this into A, B, and C. You ask how much entanglement is between A and B, B and C, A and C, and also shared among ABC. Like this kind of new questions, it cannot be just addressed by entanglement entropy. You need something called multipartite entanglement. And we will just consider a very simple quantity in this talk, which is this conditional mutual information. Many of you might already heard about it, like it's useful in condensed matter also, which I will show later. But yeah, the upshot is that like this like conditional mutual information is some linear combination of the entropy of each region. And why is this useful in condensed matter? Like if you consider a 2 plus 1D topological ground state, then you can choose ABC in different geometries, but like if you choose it in the simple geometry, which has a trivial topology, then this conditional mutual information is zero. But if you choose this more complicated geometry, which has some genus in its geometry, then you do have some topological entanglement entropy contribution. This expression just coming from a linear combination of the each of the entropies.
So for the second geometry, do
you
have boundaries?
The whole thing is like in the bulk, like this ABC. Imagine like there's a square lattice, and this ABC is just a tripartition of some part of the system. Like there are still spins in inside this hole and outside the hole. That's the usual thing. In CFT ground state, then you can also just linear combine everything, the entanglement of AB, BC, ABC, and then you realize that it has this conditional mutual information has a very simple expression in terms of the cross ratio, where the cross ratio is defined in this way. Like it's like when B is very large, then the cross ratio should be very small. If B is very small, then the cross ratio is very large. And in accordance with that, if the cross ratio is very large, which means it's close to one, then this mutual information, a conditional mutual information, should be very large. And then if eta is small, then the conditional information is also small, because at small eta, it has this expansion. So that leads us to think about like what exactly does this number mean information theoretically? Like what does this conditional information represent? Before that, let me talk about how would you interpret mutual information, which is a simpler quantity. So the mutual information is just this. We know that it's like bigger or equal to zero because of subadditivity, and the meaning of this quantity is how much correlations, either quantum or classical, are shared between A and B. And if you ask me, well, what's the operation meaning of this mutual information, it's actually the following. It's how close we can get to the state with local preparation. So let's say if I had Alice and I had Bob, and these two do not share any entanglement. They do not share any correlation. They are not allowed to do any classical communication either. So they can just do their own things. And then you ask, what's the best thing they can do to approximate the state rho AB? And then the answer is that the best they can do, quantified by this relative entropy, is given by the mutual information. And so yeah, that makes it clear that the mutual information is a measure of how much correlation there is between A and B. We want to ask the same question about the operation meaning of conditional mutual information, which is a difference between the mutual informations. And it And in fact, it quantifies how much correlations are shared between A and C that is not mediated by B. So so there could be correlations between A and C that is mediated by B. If all of the correlations are of such case, then this conditional mutual measure would equal to zero. But if there is any correlations of A and C that beyond the mediation by B, then this quantity will be non-zero and it will be greater than zero because of strong subadditivity. We will make this statement precise by giving an analogous of this expression in terms of how much you can prepare the whole state using some restricted operations. And this operation is known as page map recovery. So this is what this talk is about. I will start with what is the page map recovery, and in particular, we will study the fidelity, like how close you can prepare that state. And in two contexts, the first context is CFT. In CFT, we can do some numerics, we can do some analytical argument based on replicas. And then we also study some special class of many-body states, which are stabilized states and topological order. And we will show that the page map, in some cases, give you some better results than the conditional mutual information, and sometimes they give you the page map give you just the same thing as the conditional mutual information. Yeah. But that will go later. Let's start with what is the page map recovery. Consider the following operation. Like, you start with your tripartite state ABC, which should be in a mixed state. It could also be a pure state, doesn't matter. But in general, it's a mixed state. And then you trace out C, and then you are left with AB. And then we try to reconstruct the whole state ABC using a channel that acting only on B. So it's again like it's clear that from this procedure, there's no symmetry between A and B. So B is kind of special because like you are allowed only to act in channels on B. So that actually corresponds to the fact that this conditional mutual invasion is some quantity that describes how much information that between A and C that is not mediated by B. So B is in its special case. So that's the procedure. And then we want to ask how close we can get the state with the original state. We will call this rho tilde state, like the recovered state. We want to know how close it will be to the original state. And by close, there are many many measures of close. Like in quantum information theory, a lot. But unlike the pure state, where the only thing you can do is to compute the overlap, but for mixed state, there are actually many measures, but they are all related. There are good measures and bad measures, but I will only talk about good measures, which, for example, is the fidelity. The fidelity is defined in this way. Like, looks very complicated. It's also very hard to compute numerically, but that's common in quantum information. Whenever you are going to measure the distance of two mixed states, the best thing that you can compute is not always the best thing in quantum information theory. Usually, the best thing in quantum information theory is very hard to compute. So that's the fidelity. And there are also some other examples called trace distance or Rényi relative entropies. I will not talk about them, but we have them in the paper, but they do have some relationship with this fidelity. So if the fidelity is close to one, then it means that trace distance is also small and relative entropy is also small. We will not talk about this today. So I will only consider fidelity. So let's answer the question. How much we can recover the original state? So let's first consider the case where you have perfect we could have perfect recovery. That is, this fidelity is one. This is actually a special case, and it's worked out by PET, last century. So very old result. It says that This is possible. This perfect recovery is possible only if and only if the conditional mutual information is zero. So that's actually the first hint of our idea that the conditional mutual information is correlation between A and C that is not mediated by B. Because if this quantity is zero, then it means that the correlation between A and C is completely mediated by B. Then by acting with the channel on B, then you can recover the whole information on C because you already know A. So this theorem gives you the precise meaning of this quantity when this quantity is zero. And actually, Pates also shows that you can use the following map to reconstruct the state if this perfect recovery is possible. So it's given by density matrix of AB, density matrix of BC, and B. Notice that there's no dependence on ABC because you are not allowed to use that. So the only thing that appears is the density matrix of AB and BC. So using this formula, of course, although it is not really clear that this thing is a channel, it is actually is, but it's not very straightforward to see that. But still, using this quantum channel, you can actually recover the whole state if the conditional mutual information is zero.
What's the definition of channel?
Oh, okay. A quantum channel is a completely positive trace preserving map. Trace preserving meaning that whenever you put here, if you input a density matrix, the output will always be trace one. And then completely positive simply means that if you put a positive matrix here, then you get a positive density matrix here after the output. That's positive. That was positive mean, but complete positive is more complicated. But it's okay. So.
Jay, sorry, I'm probably confused by something about something very basic. So the density matrices, they act on different Hilbert spaces. So what do you mean when you multiply them together?
Oh, you tensor product them with identity. So
that's what you're
talking about. Right. And the following theorem actually makes it more clear what this conditional information means, when it's equal to zero, what that exactly means. This theorem is actually a very special case in quantum information where you can actually write down some closed expression of the density matrix. It's given by Hayden Winter in 2003. It says that if this perfect recovery is possible, then you can always write the state in the following way. This looks a little bit technical, so I will try to explain it. So this notation meaning direct product, this meaning direct sum. So let's first ignore about the direct sum part. It just says that you can separate the Hilbert space B into the left part and right part. You can just think of this as a one spin on the left and one spin on the right, for example. And then there's a direct sum. It says that there are many such these pairs which do not talk to each other. And then this expression says that let's first also look at the case where there's no direct sum, which means there's not sum here. It means that. And it also says that this P is should equal to 1. So it just says that A is just entangled with the left part of B, and C is just entangled with the right part of B. Then from this form, you see that the correlation between A and C is like kind of doesn't exist because A is just entangled with B, so it cannot entangle. A is just entangled with the left part of B, so it has not a room to entangle with C. So when there's no sum, A and C are not correlated, and that's a special case. But when there is a direct sum, then it says that you can have a mixture of all such states. And in this case, actually, A and C do have some classical correlations, but these classical correlations, they are completely mediated by B because A is just A is just correlated with like some part of B, and B is just correlated, and C is also just correlated with some other part of B. But then you add an overall classical correlation upon this structure, and the correlation of A and C, then they are completely mediated by B. So that's, but I will not use this result later. I just want to show you there's a beautiful result which basically quantifies the intuition that what this means for what's the meaning of the conditional mutual information.
Is there a similar statement on correlation functions?
Yes, indeed. Right. So let's go back to this. If the mutual information is zero, then it implies that rho AB is a product state. Because if this is zero, then the minimization of this relative entropy is zero, then relative entropy is zero only if the two states are the same. So these two states must be the same thing. And by correlation, then all correlations are zero, right? And actually, there's a theorem saying that the mutual information is an upper bound to all correlation functions. Yeah, so that's the analog of correlation functions. Yeah, sorry, I skipped that. Okay.
Sorry, I have a question. Are these rho j's really density matrices, or they are just some positive matrices?
They are density matrices. Yeah, yeah.
How do we interpret density matrices of a given index j? Because there is a direct sum in the Hilbert space. It's not just.
Yeah. So it says that like this row only has support in this Hilbert space. It can have many zeros on other Hilbert space. So that makes it a whole density matrix. Is that what you're asking?
So I mean, how can we physically make a direct sum of spaces?
It's not physical. Yeah, direct sum is not physical. Yeah, it's just a mathematical way to decompose the Hilbert space. Yeah.
Sorry, Yijian. Let me continue my earlier question. What I meant to ask is there a similar statement on correlation function for this tripartite measure?
No, because even if this quantity is zero, then you do have, right, you have this form of the density matrix, and it's seen that the A and C, they could have some correlations. So yeah, there's no bound on the correlation. They can be arbitrarily large. But the point is that if there is any correlation between A and B, it's like mediated by B. You can, for example, consider if you know B already, then because A is just correlated with BL, so you know A, and C is correlated with BR, so you know C. So if you know B, then correlation between A and C is completely fixed. So that's the meaning of conditional mutual information. If you really want an upper bound of the correlation function between A and C, then you do need the mutual information rather than the conditional mutual information. And by the way, the mutual information and the conditional mutual information do not satisfy any inequality, which means that the mutual information might not be greater or might not be smaller than conditional mutual information. So, so they are not really related to each other. Okay.
For the direct sum, physically, say that if I have some atom, it has s orbital, p orbital, and so on.
Yeah.
These different orbitals form a direct sum.
Yes, exactly. Right.
Can I interpret this rho ABJ as some density matrix only for part of the orbitals?
Right, exactly, right. Yeah, you can think of you divided the orbitals by two halves, which are completely orthogonal to each other. Yeah, that's the meaning of direct sum. Yes, and only one half of the orbital is entangled with A, and the other half is entangled with C, basically.
And regarding the equation above, you said for any lambda in R, meaning for any lambda, it's a perfect
recovery. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah, this is a bit surprised, but yeah, that's true. Okay. So yeah, that's the whole theorem here. Okay, let's consider then approximate recovery, which is actually more interesting in condensed matter setting because in condensed matter system you always have correlation lens, or you always in CFT you always have finite size corrections, so that's not really equality. So what happens when you have a small but non-zero conditional mutual information? Then basically, this is a really hard question I want to first stress in quantum information theory, and it's only solved like several years ago. You can see the time frame, like the first result by Pez is like in the 70s or 80s. Like. So this is like a lower bound on the best recovery fidelity. So it says that the best thing you can do must be greater or equal to this quantity. It says that if the conditional mutual information is small, then the right-hand side is like close to one, so you can almost get perfect recovery. And actually, the magic thing is that you can still using almost the same kind of recovery map to reconstruct the row, but now you have to put constraint on lambda. It's just not for arbitrary lambda. So first, the first thing you can do is you can try to vary this lambda and see what the best fidelity is. And the best fidelity does satisfy this inequality. So it says, okay, the best one, the best of all these channels where you choose some lambda, but you don't know the lambda, if there exists some lambda which satisfy this inequality, which can do the job, okay? And then actually a better, like a stronger inequality says that you can take some average of the fidelity over lambda, over some suitable measure of lambda, which I didn't write down, but it's some measure of lambda. Under some measure of lambda, you can take the average fidelity, and the average fidelity is also strictly bigger or equal to this to this conditional mutual information, and these two, and of course the average fidelity must be worse than the best fidelity, but still all of these two is greater than the conditional mutual information. So okay, so in conclusion, if the conditional mutual information is small, then approximate recovery is possible. Basically it says that the best channel among all these channels can do the job, and also it says that the average channel can also do the job, but with a slightly worse fidelity, but still better than the conditional mutual information. That leads us to think about the following question. Okay, so the theorem guarantees that there's a lower bound of recovery fidelity, but it does not say how much better we can go beyond the bound. Like it can be better than the conditional mutual information, but how much better, right? Like it could be very close to one, but you don't know. Like this theorem doesn't tell you, right? This theorem just tells you that you can do good. That is given by the CMI, by the conditional mutual information. It can be better than the conditional mutual information, but this theorem doesn't tell you. So we want to study some specific examples of CFT, like CFT or stabilizer states, like this state that we care about. We want to see in this type of states, how much better we can do than the CMI bound, and also we know that this CMI conditional mutual information contains the universal information such as the central charge or the topological entropy. So the natural question to ask is that if we consider the best, for example, the best recovery fidelity, does that tell you more about the universal information? Does it tell you more about the central charge? Does it tell about the operator content? Does it rely on OPE coefficient, right? So that's the first question that we want to ask. And second question is that it's more quantum information perspective. Does this best average recovery fidelity tell us about the entanglement of the state? That's a rather abstract question, but hopefully I will make it clear that and that this quantity, like this fidelity, is useful to tell whether state is stabilized or not. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about 1+1 DCFT. So the main result in this, okay, so let's say, I didn't draw ABC, so geometry of ABC are like this. Yeah, so we use this ABC, we first erase C, and we ask how much we can construct according to B, the whole state ABC. So this is the main result, and it says that for whatever lambda, if you compute the fidelity between the reconstructed state and the original state, it must take on this form. And exponential of minus central charge times something. This something only depends on the cross ratio and lambda, and is theory independent. And this already answers the first question that I ask. Does this quantity tell you more about CFT? No, it doesn't. It tells you that our main result tells you that if you consider this recovery, then it's completely determined by the central charge. That's also interesting in another sense. So this is our main result. And also, we can plot this function. We can compute this function, and then we show that the best recovery is always achieved by lambda equal to zero. That's kind of typical in CFT. It might not be true for other states. The fidelity is actually significantly better than the CMI bound, which I will tell you why. What this means by significant. And also, average fidelity is also better, but better by a constant factor. That's kind of like this result is kind of very unexpected because there's not any a priori reason why the page by map bound is not saturated. We are still confused about that, but that's our theory and numerics shows.
Actually, Yijian, I have a question. Could you go back to the theorem 3 earlier? Yeah, so I want to make sure I understand. So this particular channel, do they know that this is the best channel, or is just a channel that gives you that satisfies that bound?
They don't know whether it's the best channel or not.
I see.
Yeah.
And you're, but for your numerics, you are using this kind of channel.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, so yeah, that's unfortunate because we cannot actually do this maximization. It's really hard. So
when you say the best channel, you are optimizing within this.
Yeah. The best channel, which within this class, which like basically varying lambda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Question: did you say that lambda and c in the most recent slide are parameters in the CFT?
This one?
Yeah. Is there some interpretation of C and lambda within the CFT, or is it just coming from the...
C is the central charge, right? This lambda is artificial. It's a number that appears in this map. What you can tune. And eta is the cross ratio. I think the important thing is that this thing is like doesn't really depend on theory. So this is some function, and then you only have a dependence on central charge. So this function doesn't tell you more about the CFT than the central charge. That's unfortunate, but it does tell you something about the entanglement of the state, because for example, it tells you that CFT is not a stabilizer, which is kind of a trivial statement. But I will go into that. Let's actually first see some numerics.
Just a basic question. Mm-hmm. Is the B region always the one in the middle?
Yes, right. Exactly. Right. A, B, C are their contiguous. That's important. And then B is in the middle. We can tune B to be large or to be small. And that gives you how the conditional information would change.
It might be hard to say, but do you have any intuition why this fidelity is universal? Because if you want to calculate the entanglement of AC,
mm-hmm.
it's not just, there is no simple formula, there is a model dependent term in entanglement.
Right, good.
So how does this cancel?
Yeah, good question. So first thing, let's go back to this. The conditional mutual information actually does not depend on the operator content, right? It's like, record the definition SAB plus SBC plus minus SB, minus SABC. They're all contiguous regions. So there's no dependence on the operator content. But if you just consider the mutual information, is between disconnected, like between disconnected intervals, then it does depend on the operator content. So for example, like the long distance limit, like they decay as some power, as the distance to some power, where this power is the lowest scaling dimension. So from this lower bound, you already see that it's only dependent on the dependent on the central charge. So let's go back here. So we know that this F is lower bounded by something that only depends on the central charge. Then how can F be? Then there are only two possibilities. One is that F is also only dependent on the central charge, and this function ensures that it's universally better than the conditional mutual information. Secondly, there's a second more interesting alternatives, which is actually not true, is that this F actually also depends on the operator content, but the dependence of operator content is such that it's always bigger than something that only depends on the central charge. That would imply that there's some relation with operator content and the central charge. Apparently we find that that is not true. So it's actually the simpler choice where this F only depends on central charge, and the conditional mutual information also is just depends on the central charge, and they satisfy the inequality. Does that answer the question? Okay, thanks.
I mean, there is no AC in the calculation.
No.
Okay, so that's why.
Okay, and also if you look at this this expression, there's no AC.
Right.
Okay. So let's see some numerics. First, convince you that there's really some theory independent thing happening.
Actually, I suppose I have tripod had ABC,
mm-hmm.
and I know AB, BC, and AC. Is it always the case that I can reconstruct ABC?
No. No, that's a very hard question. Like, if you ask, like, in quantum information theory, they ask whether it is possible to determine the whole state from the marginals, marginals meaning subsystems. It's actually a very hard question that is not known. Like, even determining whether it's possible or not, I think it's not solved. Okay. But one example is that if you do have this conditional information equal to zero, if you know that, then it's possible, given by this path zero. Okay. Let's look at some numerics. Like, we consider different lambdas, and then if you look at this line, this line actually represents three models, which are labeled by different labels, like different markers. You may not be able to see it because it's too small, but yeah, but the upshot is that if you consider the minus log f over the central charge, which means that you are considering this function, then it's actually independent of the theory. Like it depends on lambda. Different colors mean different lambdas, but for each color, there's actually many markers, and which denotes these three models, you see that they are nicely collapsed onto the same curve. So this phase map fidelity, it only depends on the central charge. Does not depend on any operator content. And in particular, you can try to vary the radius of the free boson. It doesn't depend on that either. That's a numerical way to do it. If you are interested, we talk about that later.
So how do you find the fidelity using MPS?
Yeah, so that's a good question. if you want to know that, we can talk about it later. Sorry, I didn't prepare the slides for that. But basically, you want to use something called Woolman theorem. Do you know that?
No.
Woolman theorem says that the fidelity is the best fidelity between purifications. And with MPS, you can easily construct any purification of the mixed state, and then you optimize over such purification. It's actually also very straightforward. The whole calculation is very cheap. it's very cheap. Like there's like 10,000 points on each of the curves. And it only takes one hour to run, so it's actually very cheap. So let's look at several limits of this when eta goes to zero or eta goes to one. Like recall that when eta goes to zero, you have very small conditional mutual information, which means that perfect recovery is almost possible. And then with this limit, eta goes to one, it says b is very small, so basically the conditional information is very large, so it's not really possible to reconstruct the state. So first let's look at the long distance, long b limit, meaning that perfect recovery is possible. So look at this figure. There are three curves. There's one which is conditional mutual information, and as is as we know, it's like linear in the cross ratio. So it's a line. This line has slope one. This is log plot. This line is slope one, and then you can try to compute the max fidelity, the best fidelity. This means the best fidelity, and this means the average fidelity. And you can see that the average fidelity seems to follow in the same trend as the conditional mutual information all the way, and they differ by a constant. So which means that the max fidelity is better than the conditional mutual information, but it has an overall factor, and we work out this factor numerically. But then what's more interesting is actually when you consider the max fidelity, you see completely different scaling at small eta, right? For example, if you have eta is 10 to the minus 2, then basically the conditional mutual information tells you that you can do like the fidelity that is 0.999, but actually even within the page map, the best fidelity gives you 0.9999. They are more nice. So that is a little bit surprising. And then the scaling is different. You can see like a different power law. So that is indicated here. So the best fidelity has an eta square, and the average fidelity is linear in eta. And there's some number 0.055. Remember the conditional for the conditional mutual information, this number is 1/3. So in that case they differ by a constant, but for this best fidelity it's really like a significant improvement than the CMI bound. We don't know the reason yet. But what we know is that this thing is universal. Like that doesn't really depend on what CFT you are. It only depends on CFT. The fact that it is a CFT. This is the long B limit, and then we can try to we want to see like how does this fidelity depend on different lambda. So this plot shows that how much what's the fidelity for different lambdas, and it basically says that lambda equal to zero is the best, and then when you increase the lambda, it becomes worse and worse, and in particular the scaling also becomes worse. Like there's a power p that actually varying slowly with lambda. This is showing that lambda equal to zero is the best recovery we can do among this page map for the CFT. So that's the numerical result. And also then at short distance, we have this expression. We can actually show, so unlike the long distance limit, we can actually prove this formula. I will show you the proof. It says that the same quantity, which as the previous page, which is the universal function that we have, is like 1 over 9 log 1 over 1 minus eta plus constant plus and some subleading term. We can work out this exponent explicitly. And also, remember that the CMI, the conditional mutual information, gives you 1/3 one third here, so this is one ninth. So it's actually also better than the conditional mutual information. And here the case is that different lambda differ by the constant term. Yeah, and this figure is just an extrapolation to extrapolate the constant piece. Yeah, it's a little bit complicated extrapolation, but yeah, what it means is it's just like the quantity fidelity satisfies this formula. So I will prove this using a replica trick. So here's how the replica trick works. So first line. I think I need some explanation on this line. So the fidelity is actually is usually written in this very complicated form, but actually you can also write it in this way: trace of rho times sigma to the 1/2. You wonder what does this mean, right? Because rho times sigma is not a Hermitian operator anymore. So what does it mean to take the power of 1/2? But actually, even though rho times theta is rho times sigma is not a Hermitian operator, it does have eigenvalues which are all positive. So by this 1/2, we just mean you first take the eigenvalue decomposition, and then you just take the square root of the eigenvalue. And yeah, that's what this 1/2 means. So this is the first line about the fidelity. And then we can try to write down our expression to compute, where first we have this page map regression in terms of all the rows. And then we want to reconstruct this state, row ABC, and then we take the fidelity, which according to the expression, we just multiply them and take the whole thing to the 1/2 power. And then we do some very dangerous things, which we try to make all these numbers integers. So we define this Rennie version depending on this k, n1, n2, m1, m2, which are all integers. And then if we can actually evaluate these expressions analytically in terms of all these m's and n's and k, we take this replica limit. So that's the how the replica limit works, but unfortunately we cannot actually work out analytically this expression. So the best thing you can do is we can work out some limit. So actually let's go a little bit more how we may compute this complicated expression. So actually, you can rewrite the whole expression in terms of some replica, some twist operator formalism. So first, you calculate how many copies there is. And in this case, it's m1 plus n1 plus 1 plus m2 plus n2 plus 1, and then everything times k. So n equals to this quantity, the quantity that I mentioned, and then there's a times k here. So you have total number of these copies, and then you assign some twist operators or some permutations of the replicas on A, B, and on C. And these permutations, they are specified by this multiplication structure. You try to work out the correct permutations which reproduce such multiplications. And it turns out that this twist operators or the permutations, they are like this way. It's a little bit complicated, but yeah, I'm not going to details about this. So that's the first step. Like you write them in terms of twist operators, and then you try to write on the path integrals. Like the path integral here is that you have these so many copies, and on the ABC, you assign different boundary conditions, according to that twist operators. So you have different you identify, for example, this slice with something like this slice, right? This is going to be determined by the twist operator. It's again complicated, but upshot is that you are ready to write it down as a four-point correlation function of twist operators, where you have some twist condition on A and on B and on C. So what you want to insert is some boundary condition chaining operators, on A, on the first point, second point, third point, and fourth point, and they are determined by the permutation group. At this point, everything is very abstract. And then if we want to go a little bit more concrete, then we need the properties of the twist operators. So first, twist operators are primary operators. And we know that twist four-point function of primary operator depend on scaling dimension and LPE. And the scaling dimensions, what is the scaling dimension of the twist operators? They're actually completely determined by the so-called cycle decomposition. So you know that in a permutation group, you can always decompose any elements of the permutation group by a product of cycles. Cycles meaning that 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and 2, 3 to 1, like this kind of cyclic permutations. If you have m cycles, if this twist operator have m cycles, and each cycle has length ni, then this is the scaling dimension.
Are you saying the twist operator is a primary operator for single CFT or n copies?
N copies.
Okay.
Yes. Actually, more precisely, is that it's the primary operator for the orbifold CFT. You need to orbifold by the permutation group. Okay. According to this structure, like this complicated structure, we can actually work out what this M and Ni is for all the twist operators. And it turns out that the scaling dimensions all go to zero in this replica limit. Like if you take this limit, then the scaling dimensions go to zero. So what does this mean? Is that you have four primary operator insertions where these four primary operators have scaling dimension zero. And scaling dimension zero meaning that it's invariant on the scale transformations. So thus, that's the fidelity that we consider is only a function of cross ratio and doesn't really depend on the length scale. So it's finite in the UV and in the IR. Like it's only depend on the dimensionless parameter. So that's exactly what happens here, right? So here we have a central charge in the front, but then we have some function that depend on eta. We don't have anything like the length, different lengths of ABC. And okay, so this is the first result of the replica formalism, and then the second result of the formalism is that it's independent of the operator content. So how do we see that? There's some formula called Riemann-Hurwitz formula. It basically says that how you can compute the genus of this manifold, because you already make some twisted boundary conditions here and here and here, so it's a little bit complicated. Like how do you see like the overall genus of the manifold? But it turns out that there's a formula called Riemann-Hurwitz formula that also only depends on the cycle structure. We work it out and we show that it's genus zero. And if it is genus zero, then what we can do is we can try to write down a conformal transformation to map the manifold to a sphere. Severe meaning that there's still genus zero, right? And we know that under conformal transformation, like the conformal factor, the CFT partition function, they change according to something called Liouville factor. This Liouville factor only depends on the central charge, and the rest thing is some action which only depends on the scaling function phi. Which is completely determined by the geometry. We know that because we have mapped it to a sphere, which is a regular sphere, so there's no twist operator anymore, so no twist operator insertion in this geometry, the partition function is one. So the original partition function we are considering is nothing but the Liouville factor. The Liouville factor, again, only depends on the central charge and the geometry. And again, the geometry is only a function of the cross ratio. You don't worry about like the operator content. So that shows that the whole quantity is independent of the operator content. This is true even if one cannot explicitly work out what is the map.
Question. Mm-hmm. From that, I would think this four-point function equals this zero-point function.
Yes. Yes. Right. Exactly. That's also what is when you compute the Rényi entropy, like Rényi 2 entropy of one interval. That's also what happens, there. Right? Like you have the usual Cauchy calibrations thing. Yeah.
How?
You, you map that, so you have two, let's say you have second rank entropy, you have two copies, and then you do some twist bound condition on A, and you can map this to a single copy using some conformal mapping. And the Liouville action of that mapping is precisely the this rank entropy.
The twist operator is also like basically become some kind of boundary condition, so it disappears. So the operator just disappears.
Yeah, just disappear. Yeah, because it's like boundary conditions. Yeah. And this conformal transformation just it's going to make this boundary condition disappear. Yeah, that's some magic happens in 2D CFT because there are a lot of room for conformal transformation, which can allow you to change the topology. Okay. And finally, a final result that we can get from the replica formalism is that you can try to use the OPE to construct see what's the leading behavior like this one. When two of the points are small. When two of the points are close to each other. And in fact, this only works for one limit. We take the B to be very small, and in this case, you can first fuse the operator insertion at x2 and x3, and then it turns out that there's a fusion like this, and this prefactor 0 and i is determined by the scaling dimension of the twisted operator, as it's turned out to be 0 and i, and then the subleading one. It's a descendant, but in this orbifold theory, there's something particular called fractional descendant, which happens, but if you don't know that, that's okay. But yeah, then this fractional descendant gives you a subleading exponent, which is 3/3, so 2/3. So then that's if you do that OPE, then this is exactly what you get. The fidelity must first have this 1/9, which comes from this 1/9, and then it has a subleading term, which is 3/2, 2/3, which is again this 2/3. So that's basically the main result. And then I will go to other examples, which are quite quick, which may take 5 minutes. But before that, for the CFT part, questions? Okay, good. Okay, and then perhaps for our condensed matter community, like this result is more interesting. Like for stabilizer state and for the topological ground state, we actually both show that this CMI bond is saturated. So for example, like for the stabilizer state, you can also construct this map, and this map, and we can show that the reconstructed state is independent of lambda, and this fidelity is saturated, and if you agree with this result, then it basically shows that the CFT is not a stabilizer, because for CFT this is not an equal sign, right? So then for 2+1D topological order ground state, doesn't really depend on whether it's toroid or not, because for toroid code it's already included in the first case. But even if it's not a toroid code, even if it's chiral topological order, even like it may be very strange. If you assume something called intermittent bootstrap, then you can also show that this fidelity is saturated. So how do we do that? For stabilizers. I will remind you what a stabilizer means. A stabilizer means first has a stabilizer group which has generators G1 to Gn, where all of these generators commute and just raise it to some power 0 to 1. So that gives you a abelian group to the order of 2 to the n. And then a stabilizer state is completely specified by this group, which is form. And then the entropy of this state is also known. It's just the total number of spins minus the number of stabilizers. And the good thing about stabilizers is that you actually know that these powers, which is very hard to tackle in general, is become trivial, because each of these terms is the projector, so it's to some power, it's the same thing. 1 to some power is 1, 0 to some power is 0, so there's just a proportional constant. And then we know what the reconstructed state look like. If you look at this expression, then basically it says that the reconstructed state has all the stabilizers that supported on AB and BC. but they lack stabilizers that is jointly supported on ABC, that is a non-local stabilizer. And one can actually show that this number of missing stabilizers, which is not given by this form, is exactly the conditional misformation because of this entropy, and also is exactly equal to the fidelity. That's a special result about the stabilizer. So basically, in this case, the Petermann fidelity is given by the missing stabilizers in the reconstructed state, and which turns out to be exactly the CMI. So that's the outline of the proof. Okay. So this.
In this case, do you know that the recovery channel is optimal?
I don't, but perhaps it is. Yeah. Yeah, at least like within the page map, like this lambda doesn't matter. So yeah, it's like all of the page map give you the same answer. Okay. And then for topological order, we use something called entanglement bootstrap, and I'm skipping all the assumptions details of this this entanglement bootstrap. But the upshot is that you can try to consider this state where you put the ground state, but you put anion A and A bar in this way, and then this the whole density matrix row ABC will actually depend on what anion you put in the middle, but depending on A, they are mutually orthogonal. So different A's correspond to different density matrix which are living orthogonal subspace. Okay, and then. But also we know that each of the subsystem rho AB and rho BC is independent of the anion insertion. Because, for example, if you consider the density matrix of rho AB, then you can put the anion string that cross C, like you can put this anion string like this, and then you see that there's no operators on acting on AB, so rho AB is unchanged. But again, like for BC, you can try to put the anion string here, so. Yeah, so it's so the density matrix of BC and AB like independent, and recall that like the constructed state only depend on rho AB and rho BC, so the reconstructed state also doesn't depend on A, but the ground state the reconstructed state doesn't depend on A, but the state rho ABC, the real state rho ABC, does depend on what anion you put. So that gives us the following result, that the reconstructed state is a linear superposition or mixture of all the anion configurations. And the way we show that is that for this state, we actually have the conditional information equal to zero, which is given by the topological entanglement formula, and because of this, then we get perfect recovery for this state. And as I said, the recovery is independent of which anion you insert. So for any anions you get this the same state. And again, like the fidelity of this state to the ground state, which means no anions, is like given by topological entanglement entropy. So that's the result in this topological case. If you assume entanglement bootstrap, then basically, for any topological order, this page map recovery gives you the same. Okay. So that is the final remarks. So what we want to do later is like we have that function which I plotted, but we don't know the analytic form, and then. Then there are some additional quantum information questions, such as if B is large, then what is the entanglement between A and C? What is the correlation between A and C? Are they quantum or classical? Like this type of more information theoretic questions. And also, I didn't mention there are some implications on measurement-induced phase transitions, because for stabilizer state, so this phase map fidelity is saturated. So that implies actually some conformal data of the measurement-induced phase transition, and it might not be the same thing as the harm random measurement-induced phase transition. And finally, as we said, like the page, we originally want the page map give you more information about the universal properties, but it turns out that either for the topological case or for the CFT case, it doesn't seem to give you more information than the CMI, which is like topological entropy and single charge. So, but it would be interesting if we could work out at least some examples where this page map gives you more information, so that this will be a useful quantity to compute. Okay, that's it.
So we have time for one or two quick questions.
Just a general question, maybe not that related. Mm-hmm. You know, if there is any way of calculating, doing this type of calculations using quantum Monte Carlo?
Again, with quantum Monte Carlo, I think the you can easily compute this quantity, which is
the replica one,
which is this one. You can compute this quantity, which is maybe this one, because like for quantum Monte Carlo, you just apply some twisted boundary conditions. The same thing happens for tensor networks. This type of quantity is always easy to compute, but again, for anything to make sense in quantum information theory, you have to take this replica limit, which is typically 1/2, but you cannot really do 1/2 either in quantum Monte Carlo or in tensor network. In tensor network, you have to do the full inverse. That's kind of you want to do the full eigenvalue decomposition. That's also very hard. So I just cannot think of any other way to compute it. Yes, that's I think a general remark. Whenever you consider anything meaningful in quantum information, that's usually very hard to compute using any numerics.
Another urgent question, because EJ is always here, so
yeah.
Thank you again. Okay.